Hello, I'm Nick Clark. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, giving up nuclear energy, Germany powers down its last reactors, while other countries are looking to expand their plants. Should atomic energy remain part of the energy mix? Also this week, the Brazilian president is cozying up with China. So why is Beijing expanding its economic ties in Latin America's largest nation? And how far will that partnership go? Plus, Lula da Silva has challenged Western-led financial institutions during his China trip and called on BRICS nations to end the dominance of the US dollar in international trade. So then, anti-nuclear activists have spent decades fighting for this very moment. Germany has now shut down its three remaining atomic power plants. Supporters of the decision say the reactors are a dangerous and unsustainable source of energy, and retiring them makes the country safer. But critics are questioning how the country can secure enough energy to drive the economy as it reduces dependence on gas supplies from Russia. Victoria Gatenby has this report.
Environmental activists celebrate the end of an era, the closure of the Neckarwestheim nuclear power plant. Along with the shutdown of two other reactors, it finalizes the phasing out of nuclear power in Germany.
This is a big success for us. I think one of the reasons, if not the main reason, was Fukushima in 2011. But I also think that our decades-long fight against nuclear power has played a role.
The decision was announced more than a decade ago by then-Chancellor Angela Merkel after the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan. Critics have long described nuclear power as dangerous and unsustainable.
The consequences of a real nuclear accident can be catastrophic. And I remember, after speaking in the same platform as Naoto Kan, who was the Prime Minister of Japan at the same time, we had supper afterwards, and being astonished when he turned to me and said, well, look, if the wind was in the wrong direction, we would have lost Tokyo.
But opponents have criticized the closures given the challenges caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the energy crisis. They say Germany will be forced to rely more heavily on polluting coal and natural gas to meet its energy needs. The climate minister says the remaining plants only generated up to 6% of the country's power during the past year, and their closure won't affect energy security. Yet some question whether the German public is ready for renewable alternatives.
The renewables expansion has been planned a certain way, but we do not know if Germans will tolerate the further construction of wind turbines in their villages. I know the Germans say they support it in abstract, but it's not clear that that will happen. So counting future weather and climate-based energy as for sure going to come and replace the nuclear electricity that is lost and being replaced by the coal electricity now, I don't know.
Other industrialized countries are working on replacing fossil fuels with nuclear energy, but supporters of the shutdown insist it's the right move and they hope other nations will follow. Victoria Gatenby for Counting the Cost.
All right, let's have a look at the nations expanding their nuclear plants. The UK is in the process of building a new plant and aims to start working on 8 reactors by the end of the decade. France gets about 70% of its power from nuclear and is planning to build 6 new reactors. Finland opened its 5th nuclear plant last year. Japan is still dealing with the aftermath of the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster, but it's considering restarting 7 reactors. The United States, the world's biggest nuclear power, it started up a new reactor in March, its first new plant in nearly 7 years, while China has the world's fastest growing nuclear energy program and one of the youngest, with as many as 55 reactors. Let's take this on. Joining us from London is Ellie Chambers, who's an analyst of EU power markets, the Independent Commodity Intelligence Services. Ellie, welcome to Counting the Cost. So first up, where do you stand on this? Is this the right decision, do you think, from Germany?
In my own personal opinion, this is not the right decision for Germany. I think when you take into account the costs of the alternative sources that Germany will have to use to fill this gap, that's left by the nuclear phase out. It's my opinion that this isn't a positive move.
So tell us about that gap and how it would be filled and the kind of costs that we're talking about and how long that's going to go on for? Because, you know, ideally there is a transition taking place, an energy transition taking place.
Our model runs indicated that there would be a large gap left by the phase out of nuclear. And that will be mainly filled by imports of power from other countries. And the countries that are likely to raise their exports to Germany the most are the Netherlands and France. So you can almost see like a bit of hypocrisy in there, because a lot of French electricity is generated from nuclear plants itself. Mm. Also, you will get some more contribution from fossil fuel plants. That will primarily be coming from gas plants, followed by lignite and coal. And when you look at the costs of these different types of electricity, nuclear does have high startup costs, but obviously Germany already had these nuclear plants, so that wasn't really something that had to be considered. The running costs of nuclear plants are very low compared to fossil fuel plants. And in fact, even when you take like all the costs into consideration, in most countries, electricity produced from nuclear plants will be a lot cheaper to produce.
So from the point of view of those who are supporting this move by Germany, they're celebrating hugely, aren't they? Because it's the end of what they perceive to be a dirty and dangerous fuel.
If you perceive it as dirty, I suppose there are kind of two aspects that make a plant dirty or not dirty. And one of them is whether it emits carbon. And obviously fossil fuels emit a lot more carbon than nuclear plants. But the side that you're probably talking about is that it produces nuclear waste. So you could say that it's not sustainable in that way, yes.
When we look at the nuclear energy industry, do you think it should be part of the ongoing energy production system for the world, or should it just be part of the transition ultimately to totally renewable?
I mean, the thing about nuclear is that it does provide a largely stable, consistent form of energy, and it can run nearly 24/7. And that's not something that renewables can do at the moment. And while we are having new technologies come in, which could serve to balance the system the rest of the time, we're not really seeing battery storage, for instance, at a scale where it could do that at the moment. And another option is hydrogen. Well, hydrogen is quite untested as an energy storage technology. So we have yet to see whether either of those can really be a viable alternative to the consistent, stable supply of energy that comes from nuclear plants.
All right. Ellie Chambers, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, China went from once having little trade with Brazil to being its top trading partner in 2009, outpacing the United States. And at that time, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was serving his first tenure as Brazil's president. Lula is now back in office, and he's recently visited Beijing in an attempt to repair ties that had suffered under Jair Bolsonaro's presidency. The visit was also aimed at boosting trade between the two countries even further. Brazil signed several new economic agreements with China during the trip, including pacts on agricultural trade, aviation and investments. trade value between the two countries reached more than $150 billion last year. China is a major buyer of Brazilian soybeans, iron ore, and crude oil. And Brazil is a top recipient of Chinese investments in Latin America. Well, the two nations took steps to make it easier to settle their foreign trade operations in their currencies last month. The Brazilian president visited the Huawei facility in Shanghai. The technology company is sanctioned by the US over national security concerns. His trip has also included the swearing-in of former Brazilian president Dilma Rousseff as head of the new China-led New Development Bank, which funds infrastructure projects in many developing nations. Well, President Lula is seeking partnerships to challenge Western-dominated economic institutions, and he's called on the BRICS bloc, which is made up of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, to create an alternative currency to the dollar for use in trade between them.
Every night I ask myself, why should every country have to be tied to the dollar for trade? Why can't we trade in our own currency? And why don't we have the commitment to innovate? We need to have a currency that puts countries in a slightly calmer situation, because today a country needs to run after dollars in order to export, when it could export in its own currency, and the central banks could certainly take care of that. Why can't a bank like the BRICS Bank have a currency to finance trade between Brazil and China, between Brazil and other BRICS countries?
Well, to discuss all of that, I'm joined now by our two guests, Jimena Blanco, who is Research Director and Head of America's Risks Insights at Verisk Maplecroft, joins me now from Benalmádena in Spain. And from Singapore is Chen Gang. He's an Assistant Director and Senior Research Fellow of the East Asian Institute at the National University of Singapore. Welcome both. And Jimena, if I could start with you. So bilateral trade has, of course, ballooned between Brazil and China in recent years. So just how significant are these new agreements?
The new agreements are very significant in the sense that they bring Brazil back to China. And it's Lula's opportunity to try to, put fuel back in the Brazilian economy and mark a very different policy from his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. So, of course, you know, for Lula in particular, infrastructure investment and, bringing back life to Brazil's industrial heartland are crucial. And he hopes that China will be able to give Brazil that lifeline, particularly with his own support base in the industrial sector.
Indeed. So Chen Gang, from China's point of view, what are the upsides of this arrangement?
Yeah, actually, for Xi Jinping, I think Lula's visit to Beijing is very important for his third world foreign policy these days. And economically, I think this is also very important for China, a country that needs the recovery of its economy very badly this year, because last year China didn't meet its economic target of about 5%. So I think for China, Brazil is important because of its resources and raw materials, especially because we know that China now has become one of the world's largest manufacturing hubs in the world. So it needs a lot of resources and energy and agricultural products, which Brazil can provide a lot for China. So I think this visit is very important for Xi Jinping.
Jimena, you talked about industrial policy, very important for Lula, and China's investment in Brazil's infrastructure projects. What kind of thing are we talking about and how important will that be?
Well, we're talking about two things in particular. I mean, when it comes to industry, Chinese companies are entering Brazil in areas where Western manufacturers are leaving. So, for example, if we think about the automaker industry and car factories that need new buyers in northeastern Brazil, and those new buyers came in from China when the country needed them. The other side of the equation has to do with interconnectivity within Brazil to reduce costs and ease the transport of goods out to ports and across to Asia. We often cite the fact that it's more expensive to transport one ton of soy within Brazil than from a Brazilian port to China. And so what Lula is looking for here is investment in road, in railway, and in port infrastructure on the one hand, and on the other hand, also on telecommunications. And that's where that visit to Huawei, besides being controversial or eyebrow-raising from Washington, is particularly interesting from a Brazilian domestic policy perspective.
Right, and Jimena, on Washington, Lula, of course, has been upping the multilateral agenda altogether, but when he went to Washington, he didn't seem to go with a whole array of business deals. There wasn't so much of a business agenda on the table there, but China was completely different. Jimena, why do you think that was?
Well, I mean, this goes partly into playing into what, you know, Brazilian diplomats are calling active non-alignment, right? The agenda with Washington is more along issues around human rights, climate change, democracy, protecting democracy in the region. These are issues that don't sit or don't align particularly well with the agenda in Beijing, which is around trade and investment. That doesn't mean that the U.S. doesn't remain an important investor in Brazil. In fact, you know, it is a huge foreign direct investor in Brazil, and U.S. companies operate in the country, you know, including in areas where they compete with Chinese investors like oil and gas and mining. So, you know, for Lula, this is a moment where he wants to show that Brazil can be in the global arena, talking to different partners and leading emerging markets in this conversation. And it's this idea about, you know, Brazil can lead Latin America and other global South economies in a multipolar world that includes China and the United States as crucial partners.
Chen, I'd like you to reflect on that as well. And then I want to move on to the issue of the US dollar dominance and the call for that to change. But first of all, just respond to what Jimena was just saying.
Yeah, for the I think definitely this currency cooperation is one of the focuses for Lula's visit to China, because both countries actually have the incentives to use their own currencies for trade, bilateral trade, and also investment. As these days, I think an increasing number of countries actually are feeling that actually relying too much on the U.S. dollar for trade and investment sometimes could cause some problems. So that's why I think for Lula's visit to China, I think this is one of the issues they discussed. And also, I think they are going to move forward to use their currencies more often, as China has been Brazil's major trading partner for years. So there shouldn't be much issue about using their own currencies.
In a broader sense, Chen, how much is it going to affect the dominance of the US dollar in international trade? Because trade in China's currency still only accounts for about 3% of central bank reserves, and that's compared to 60% for the US dollar.
Yes, although I think China and a number of other countries actually are trying to use their currencies more often for global trade and also investment, there's still a long way to go before these currencies can really play a major role in global trade and investment and replace the US dollar. Because we know that the US dollar dominance in the global financial system, trade system, has lasted for decades and also are hinged on U.S. Technological economic power, as well as the dollar oil trading system. So that's why I do not think that it's easy for these countries to move towards a de-dollarization world.
Jimena, would you like to reflect on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, increasing bilateral trade in, you know, non-dollar and particularly, you know, with China is part of an organic process in which Chinese presence in, you know, in global trade is significant. But for a country like Brazil that, also trades in commodities that are benchmarked in US dollars, it will be nearly impossible to remove itself entirely. If we think about, you know, commodities, whether it's soy, iron ore, oil and gas, you know, they're all benchmarked in dollars. So as much as Lula wants to position this detachment from the US dollar, it is something that will remain as part of global trade for the foreseeable future.
Chen, finally, if I may come to you, Dilma Rousseff, the former Brazilian president, of course, has been appointed head of the new Chinese-backed New Development Bank. What do you think about this bank, and can it become the great bank of the global south, as Lula himself has said?
Yeah, I do think that this new development bank, or the BRICS bank, does have the potential to become a global development bank for global south, which is badly needing all kinds of financial support for their infrastructure and economic development. But of course, we also have the existing mechanism, global financial mechanisms, like the World Bank, IMF, and the Asian Development Bank. So I think in the future, we're going to have a kind of competition between the conventional global financial systems and the emerging financial development banks, like the new development banks, and also some of other development banks, for example, in China. So in the future, we're going to see this kind of competition.
All right, we'll leave it there. Do appreciate your time. Chen Gang, thank you so much. And Jimena Blanco, thank you too for joining us from Spain. Thank you. Lebanon's economic collapse has devastated its banking sector and turned the nation into a cash-based economy. And that's deprived a near bankrupt government of billions of dollars in tax revenue, and it's driving illicit activity. Umay Kulsoom Sharif has more.
This currency exchange store in Lebanon's Beqa Valley is buzzing with business. Lebanon's currency is in free fall and customers want to exchange it for US dollars. In mid-March, the value of the Lebanese pound plunged to a historic low of 100,000 against the dollar. It's the result of a four-year-old financial crisis blamed on decades of government mismanagement and corruption.
People come holding bags of cash, running around. They want dollars. Whatever rate you give them, they just want dollars, fearing what will be tomorrow.
Businesses across Lebanon now operate exclusively with cash. Restaurants, coffee shops, and supermarkets have all stopped accepting card payments.
We used to sell mostly on cards, but lately we have problems with banks. They are not giving us money. When I have 20 to 30 card transactions and have, for example, $4,000, they won't even give me $500 or $400. This is why it stopped. Checks stopped. Everything today is cash.
Since 2019, Lebanese banks have imposed restrictions on cash withdrawals, locking depositors out of their savings. An estimated $8 billion is exchanging hands informally. That's causing concern, particularly among Western nations attempting to track illicit cash transactions.
It's the biggest threat that the government and the country is facing, because it is very, very, very dangerous that the entire economy is a cash economy. All the money is going to the private sector. The solution is only in one place. That is to normalize and finalize the restructuring of the banking system law.
Restructuring is one of the reforms demanded by creditors if Lebanon is to receive much-needed international support. But that means the political and business elite would have to compromise their hold on power. And that's something they've resisted so far. Umay Kulsoom Sharif, Al Jazeera, for Counting the Cost.
And that is our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything you've seen, you can tweet me at Nick Clark Al Jazz. Just use the hashtag AJCTC, or indeed drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and indeed entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nick Clark from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news is coming right up.